This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. As people get outdoors to enjoy the spring weather this year, they should also be aware of the health problems associated with bites from ticks and mosquitoes. Our guests are here to talk about insect populations and the illnesses they can cause. Hosting today's conversation is WPR's John Davis. Joining him by phone is University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist P.J. Leash. And in studio is La Crosse County Health Department Director Jen Rombalski and Gunderson Health System Infectious Disease Doctor David McNamara. But before we get into insects, we wanted to spend just a little bit of our time on a pressing infectious disease issue, the measles. As we recorded this, Wisconsin had yet to record its first case, but the measles had been reported in 23 states, including most neighboring states, except Minnesota. Jen Rombalski explains the risks.
From the public health standpoint, what we're looking at here is the spread as this continues across the nation. And I fear that it is more of a not if but when scenario. Measles is very contagious. And so, we watch this very closely, and we do have information about our vaccinated population. We happen to have about 85% vaccination status, but the national average is 91%, so we're slightly lower than that. And we do know that it's possible that we may get a case or several cases in our state.
From the physician viewpoint, certainly measles is a serious viral infection that is one of the most easily communicable viral infections known to man. So if we have cases in our population and we don't have excellent vaccine coverage, which really we do not in America, then we're very vulnerable to having outbreaks and secondary cases of what's really a very serious viral infection with the potential to really seriously hurt or injure or occasionally even kill patients, including children.
So the Wisconsin Department of Health Services announced Friday starting a new campaign to get more children immunized. Jen, is it too late for something like this to affect the current measles outbreak?
It takes about 2 weeks or so for immunization status to be full with the MMR vaccine, but the vaccine is very effective. And I would say, there aren't any cases currently in the state. There is no better time than now. If you aren't currently vaccinated, you really need to contact your primary care provider. You can call the health department. You really need to make this a priority and be up to date on vaccination status. And it's not just children. It's also adults and teens that maybe don't have both doses. We make sure that you know your vaccination status. And if you're not fully vaccinated, now is the time.
What should people know about immunizations and their importance?
Well, the measles vaccine that we have is incredibly safe. It's a very effective vaccine. We normally want to give children a first dose of it around 1 year old and then give a second dose at about 5 years of age prior to going into kindergarten. So we really want the entire population to be up to date with two doses of measles vaccine to help protect against this. Another little detail is, though, for adults who were born before 1957, we assume that they likely had natural measles infection as little kids in the 1950s. So if you're an adult born before 1957, currently we're not going back and vaccinating those people. But for anybody born 1957 or later, we want them to be up to date with two doses of measles vaccine, which is extremely safe and a highly effective vaccine.
Is there something you can do if you don't know if you're up to date or not? A test you can take or anything like that?
The best way is the Wisconsin Immunization Registry. As a parent or as an adult, you can log into the Wisconsin Immunization Registry. You can just Google that. You enter in a little bit of information about yourself, and you can find your vaccination history. If it's not complete in the Wisconsin Immunization Registry, you can contact your primary care provider as well, and they can get you a copy of your vaccine doses and different vaccines you've received.
And from the medical office perspective, what we do is we generally take a good history, try and elicit as much information as we can from that person about what they recall. We have very good access to the Wisconsin Immunization Registry, which is, for the physician, it's extremely helpful to get good vaccine data on an individual patient. But if we have questions about whether or not a person actually ever got a second vaccine or maybe got a second vaccine out of state, what we in general would do is just give that second dose of a measles vaccine right then and there in the clinic. There is a blood test we could order to try and see if a person has antibodies that would show immunity to measles. But usually, actually, the more cost-effective and more straightforward thing to do is just give a second dose of measles vaccine right at that visit. And it won't hurt if a person got multiple doses of a measles vaccine. If you had three or four doses, the vaccine would not hurt you.
Jen, according to the Wisconsin Department of Health Services, in 2018, Vernon County had the state's highest rate of two-year-olds without the measles vaccine at just over 39%. Monroe and Crawford counties are each over 25%. Should people in southwestern Wisconsin be concerned about that, that the outbreak is more likely to occur here if there is one? Because of that high percentage of gone unvaccinated?
Yeah, I mean, I think anyone who isn't vaccinated is not only at risk themselves to get measles, but they're also putting others at risk because it is so easily spread that when we recently had a case from, there was a case in Iowa County that came up through several counties in several states about a year ago or so maybe, and we, any restaurant that person was in, you know, we had to consider anyone in that restaurant potentially exposed, even if they weren't in the same area as that individual. So we just have to really be careful. And it's not just yourself that you're protecting and your family member. It's also others around you. So, I think we need to be very alert to getting in and getting vaccinated now.
The other thing for members of the public to realize is the epidemiologists will tell us to really have good population protection from a very easily communicable viral infection like measles. We need to have at least 95% of the population vaccinated, and currently we don't. So that makes us vulnerable as a society, as a population. And then the other key thing is, there are groups in our population that we don't vaccinate with measles vaccine for medical reasons. The main group is infants under about 12 months of age. So really we're trying to protect some of the most vulnerable people in our society, namely small children, infants, who are too young to get that vaccine. And then also rarely we have patients who, for a medical reason, if they're immunosuppressed or they're on big doses of steroids or they have an organ transplant, that they have a medical contraindication or reason not to get the measles vaccine. So having as many people in the population protected really helps protect that smaller group of people, especially infants who are too young to be vaccinated.
Anything either one of you want to add?
I just think, you know, I want to say that we are working diligently already with the school districts to know exactly who is vaccinated and who isn't, so that, you know, if a case does present itself, we're prepared and ready to communicate with parents and school districts and others as necessary to make sure that we do the best we can to isolate those that are ill and keep them at home and not exposing others.
We'll shift back now to our main topic today, insects and insect-borne illnesses. Our guests include La Crosse County Health Department Director Jen Rombalski, Dr. David McNamara from Infectious Disease at Gunderson Lutheran, and UW Extension entomologist P.J. Leash. P.J., do scientists make predictions about what kind of a year 2019 is going to be for insects in general?
Yeah, it's always hard to predict for insects, and one of the reasons for that is if you look at a place like Wisconsin alone, we probably have somewhere in the ballpark of 20 to 25,000 different insects. And then you add all the other arthropods, the ticks and spiders and mites on top of that, and that number will increase more. And the main thing is that each species is going to react slightly differently. If you look at some of our weather trends, and these are things that tend to influence our insects, we had the polar vortex back in January, and that's probably going to have some impacts. Hard to tell exactly what those will be, but the main point I'd want to make is it's notoriously difficult to predict kind of this time of year what the insects will be like for the rest of the year, just because the weather patterns that we experience here can really have a big influence on those.
What is the impact of the climate on things like ticks, for example?
Yes, that's a good question. And our common ticks that I think of around here, things like deer ticks and wood ticks, are pretty well adapted to our area. I had a lot of questions back in January. Did that polar vortex, you know, knock them out, so to speak? Ticks tend to spend the winter down on the ground amongst leaf litter. And a lot of parts of the state had pretty solid snow cover by the time the polar vortex got here. So that probably didn't impact them a whole lot. What I would suspect over the long run, though, is if we have climate change going on and have, say, earlier springs where the snow is melting out earlier in the season, that may end up giving us a longer season of tick activity, where instead of May being a peak season, maybe that comes a bit earlier. And so if we're adding extra months onto the calendar where we may have potential tick-human interactions, that may have some sort of role in terms of number of tick-borne disease cases that we see.
What about mosquitoes? What determines if it's going to be a bad year for mosquitoes?
Well, and with mosquitoes, it really depends on a case-by-case basis for the individual mosquito species. So in Wisconsin, we have somewhere in the ballpark of about 60 different mosquito species, and each mosquito varies in terms of its biology and habits, the number of generations per year, the type of water that they like. Some prefer very temporary, ephemeral bodies of water. Some prefer water that is going to sit there for much longer periods of time. And so each mosquito species is influenced differently by the weather patterns we get in a given year. I mean, in general, if we have years that are very, very rainy, we do tend to see, of course, more mosquitoes, and that makes perfect sense. But if you dig farther into it, more mosquitoes doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have more mosquito-borne diseases in some cases.
PJ, are there insects other than ticks and mosquitoes that cause illness?
Well, I mean, when I think of arthropods causing illness, mosquitoes and ticks would be the two main things that come to mind. Otherwise, I think of other arthropods as being more of a nuisance issue when it comes to human health, for example. We have lots of things that will perhaps bite us. You know, if you go swimming at a lake up north during the summer months, horse flies and deer flies may pester you, but they're not really transmitting diseases for us. So in Wisconsin, I really think of mosquitoes and ticks as our big two that we have to be concerned about.
Jen, how does the health department approach tick and mosquito season?
Well, you know, especially on the mosquito side, for decades, we've had a mosquito surveillance program, and we do continue that, although it's in a different form than it was in the past. In 2018, it was our first year where we focused only on those species of mosquitoes that cause disease. So there's two in particular in our county. And so previous to that, we had been doing also those that create nuisance but didn't cause disease. So we're focused in on a couple of mosquitoes in particular, and we typically run our season from May until about September. They can be prevalent after that, but primarily that's the season. And we have folks we contract for this service, and they're out in the field looking for these types of spots where mosquitoes like to breed. So for our mosquitoes in our area, we're looking at ditches, we're looking at tree holes, we're looking at artificial containers. So we're going to be sending out actually a letter to some businesses in our community very soon to talk about, can you help us by looking at some of the artificial containers you have on your properties so that we can continue to make sure we're covering as much as we can across the county.
Dr. McNamara, what are some of the most common forms of insect-borne illness that you'll see in a given year?
So the two or three main things that we would see in medical offices in La Crosse, typically we see a lot of Lyme disease, which occasionally can be very serious, affecting the heart or neurologic system or bones and joints, that kind of thing. So we see a lot of Lyme disease. Anaplasma is extremely common. And then the less common things that we see a couple cases a year typically are a viral encephalitis caused by, can be a wide variety of viruses. And then also we'll have often a couple cases of babesia, which is a tick-borne illness that is a parasitic illness. And then every few years, you know, we've had some less common things. We've seen Powassan virus here in the last few years. There was a fatality in La Crosse County last year of a person with Rocky Mountain spotted fever. We've seen some tularemia, which can be transmitted by a deer. A deer fly also can be transmitted by ticks. So we get some less common things as well.
That's Dr. David McNamara from Gunderson Lutheran Infectious Disease. We're also talking with Jen Rombalski, La Crosse County's Health Department Director, and PJ Lee, Shaggy W. Extension entomologist. We're talking about an issue that if it hasn't started yet, it soon will. The presence of ticks and mosquitoes and the health problems insects like that can cause. I'm curious, what are some of the warning signs and symptoms that someone may have if they have one of these illnesses?
The symptoms that people can have up front presenting with some of these illnesses can really overlap with each other or overlap with other common illnesses that are not tick-borne illnesses. So it can make recognizing or diagnosing some of the tick-borne illnesses a challenge up front. With Lyme disease, very commonly people will see a reddish patch on their skin in probably 50 to 60% of cases. People will see a rash and have, you know, an erythema migraine skin rash. But a lot of cases, people don't recall a rash. Certainly, the ticks are tiny. So people often won't recall having a tick on them or a tick bite or even a rash. Probably the most common symptom and presentation would really be an undifferentiated illness with a fever. So people typically have flu-like illnesses, may feel chills, weakness, malaise, and have a fever with that. And a lot of different illnesses could cause that.
How do most of the cases that you wind up seeing present themselves to you? Is it through a family care provider? Or is it through an emergency room visit? Or, you know, has somebody let the illness go that far that they're really sick with it?
So the primary care and emergency or urgent care medical staff commonly manage a lot of these infections and really do very well in a majority of the cases. So the tick-borne or insect-borne illnesses that end up getting referred to an infectious disease physician is often probably a minority of those cases. So most of our cases are referred by other members of the healthcare team who are either they've recognized something and they want some more specialty input on the treatment, or sometimes they may suspect a tick-borne illness or a, you know, have a fever type illness that they're having trouble figuring out and refer the patient to us.
What are the treatment options for these different illnesses?
So really they vary widely. And the, you know, the key thing with infectious disease, which can be difficult at times, is to try and figure out, well, what's the causative germ or the causative agent that's really responsible for that illness? So for bacterial infections like Lyme disease or anaplasma, we have really excellent antibiotics that are extremely effective at curing those infections quite easily. Commonly, we use a lot of doxycycline that would treat both of those. And then for Lyme disease, occasionally we use other sort of antibiotics in the penicillin or cephalosporin family. For a parasitic infection like babesia, the treatment's really very different, and we would use a combination of an antiparasitic plus an antibiotic. And part of the challenge is occasionally ticks will transmit multiple different infections at the same time. So people can have two or sometimes even three different infections coexisting. And so recognizing that and treating those appropriately can sometimes be a challenge.
Are there long-lasting complications with some of these diseases?
So probably the main ones that we really have recognized for a while that give long-lasting neurologic sequelae are insect-borne or mosquito-borne viral infections that give encephalitis. And in the U.S., we really mainly started recognizing that when we had West Nile virus in the 2000s. We realized that a lot of people who have a viral encephalitis end up with long-term neurologic or neuropsychiatric sequelae, because those are really very significant viral infections that affect the brain. So that's common. With Lyme disease, a lot of people will report after having Lyme disease that they're still struggling with tiredness, fatigue, malaise, joint aches. So that's common too. Even though the infection has been, you know, appropriately treated and cured, people can have, you know, in a significant minority of cases, people will have some ongoing symptoms from that.
I assume catching something as quickly as possible is the preferred way to go with these, is it not?
Sure. Just in general in medicine, yes.
And how quickly can you catch something?
Meaning, how quickly does a patient get symptoms?
Right, or, right, yeah.
So highly variable depending on, you know, the different pathogen, but often, you know, typically you would think within a week or two, most people would become symptomatic with, you know, with an infection if they'd acquired that with the tick.
PJ, do we have treatment programs around the state of Wisconsin to get at these ticks or mosquitoes that cause disease?
Yeah, well, and Jen mentioned a comment along these lines. There are, for mosquitoes, for example, often a given municipality or maybe a county will have a program that can do some kind of surveying to get an idea of what's going on in terms of mosquito development, and that might be used to make informed decisions about mosquito treatments and general abatement. So there are some programs like that. For ticks, it's much harder because ticks can be scattered and really hard to reach spots, and we're not necessarily going to be going out to these sometimes more natural areas and using pesticides. So those are harder to control. With ticks, I think more in along the lines of prevention in terms of taking some of those precautions. There are some efforts in the state to help increase general awareness about ticks. There's a relatively new smartphone app called the Tick App, for example, that is having folks look at what activities did they do outside to help kind of tease out some of these factors and help researchers figure out where folks are actually encountering the ticks.
Do parts of Wisconsin have higher concentrations of ticks or mosquitoes that cause illness?
Yeah, if you look at some of the data out there for tick-borne diseases, I mean, when we think of things like Lyme disease, we do typically see more cases in the northern part of the state. Although if you look at something like deer ticks, that to me is a really interesting situation. And if you want to talk about an emerging health threat, especially for Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, deer ticks is definitely a very relevant story, because we didn't find our first deer tick in Wisconsin until about the late 1960s. I think it was about 1970 when the first paper was published in the scientific literature saying we found deer ticks in Wisconsin. Prior to that time, you had to go much farther to the south of us. So for Wisconsin, I mean, this is really something that has popped up in the last 50 or so years. Today, you can find deer ticks in just about any county in the state, although, as I said, we do tend to see more reports of tick-borne diseases like Lyme from the northern counties compared to some of the southern counties. And the same trend with anaplasmosis tends to mirror that, because anaplasmosis is also spread by deer ticks. So I think in northern Wisconsin is having a lot of deer tick activity. But again, you can find them in any county in the state today.
So, Jen, taking off on prevention a bit, there've got to be things that people can do to prevent these ticks from, or mosquitoes from, biting you. And not just for humans. I know we all work with human populations, but also pets are a big thing.
Yeah. You know, prevention is so important, and it comes back to behavior change and just having the knowledge and awareness of where you're going to come into contact with mosquitoes and ticks and what you can do before, during, and after that contact. So starting with ticks, really you want to be wearing some type of insect repellent. We know that their active time periods, throughout the course of the year, we just tell you to always do that, to wear insect repellent with 20% or more DEET, preferably. Try to wear long sleeve pants and shirt when possible, and light colored so that you can see them when they're on you. Tuck your pants into your socks. I know that that may look funny, but if it means you may not get a nasty illness, I think it's probably worth it, especially if you're going to be in a wooded area, walking on or even off trails. You really want to have long pants, long sleeves, and tuck your pants into your socks. Wear maybe higher boots if possible. The ticks do not jump on you. They don't fall out of the trees. They're along the sort of knee down aspect of the foliage that you're going to be potentially be walking through. So just be aware of those tall bushes and other vegetation that you might brush. That's how they get on you. They have these little arms out waiting for you to walk by, and they just grab onto your clothing as you walk by. So performing daily tick checks as soon as you come in from the outdoors, you can shower, and you can also take the clothing that you had on and tumble dry that in some heat for about 10 minutes or so. That will help prevent the ticks that might be on your clothing from getting around in your house, and the shower can help you as well. It helps you just have a chance to really do a good tick check, and do this for yourself, do this for your significant other, your kids, your pets. That's just a really good way in terms of, the other piece with animals is thinking about having a preventive, like a frontline type product, something like that. Talk to your veterinarian about a way to prevent that. And, even tick collars can help too. On the mosquito side, we know that mosquitoes are most active at dawn and dusk. And even if you have an active biter type of mosquito and it isn't a disease transmitter, you're not going to know. So treat all mosquitoes the same. The prevention has a lot to do with your yard and the space around your house where you're spending your time. If you have a lot of containers, bird baths, buckets, anything that can collect water and can sit there for several days has the potential for mosquitoes to begin breeding in it, especially if there's some you know, some leaves that are rotting in a space, like a little ditch in your yard that might be collecting water, or a pond, something where there's, you know, some goods for those mosquitoes to be eating while they're breeding is also helpful. So just be aware of where you might have water collecting throughout your yard and the spaces that you're spending time in. And then, you know, just thinking about some products you can put on your clothing. There's a product called permethrin that you can spray on your clothes in advance of going out. So you would take them outdoors on a nice day and you would spray your clothes thoroughly with those ones that you might regularly go in the woods with, especially if you're an active wood, you know, walker, or you go in to watch birds or something like that. You spray your clothing down and then you let it dry in the sun, and that can last through several washings. So that's a good product to be looking out for, rather than always putting on the insect repellent only. That would give you an extra layer of protection. And, you know, there's a nice campaign, because this is hard to remember all of these things. It's called Fight the Bite, and you can go to that, and that's a website that will give you all of the tips that you might need as well.
Somebody like me who doesn't do a lot of those things probably gets bit by a couple dozen mosquitoes in a season, and I'm fine.
Mm-hmm.
So most mosquitoes that bite you do not cause illness?
It's really hard to say that. You know, there are several mosquitoes in our area, you know, a number of them. I don't know how many, but probably 10 to 12 different types. And there are two specifically that cause disease. So there are some active biters. One in particular is called the Aedes vexans. It's the inland floodwater mosquito. We have a lot of water in our area. So it's a active biter. And you won't know which mosquito is biting you, which one might have disease and which one doesn't. So, you know, we just have to be protecting ourselves and trying to minimize that.
BJ, that sounds like a question for you. How many types of mosquitoes do we have in this state, and how many can cause illness?
Yeah, so we have somewhere in the ballpark of about 60 different mosquito species. There's really a few kind of really bad apples in the bunch that I think of for spreading mosquito-borne diseases. The top one that comes to mind for mosquito-borne diseases would be the northern house mosquito, Culex pipiens. And this is a mosquito that's very widely distributed around the globe. And the reason it's of concern for us here in Wisconsin, the upper Midwest, is that one is associated with diseases like West Nile virus. And it's also an insect that does very well in urban environments. And so if you think of an urban environment, we often have these rainwater catch basins, you know, the sewer drains where water runs into and leaves and stuff gets in there. And it gets into a little cistern, and it may sit there for long periods of time, and that's a really good spot where this Culex pipiens species likes to breed. And so that is one of the main mosquito species out there. With all the different types of encephalitis viruses out there, we've got eastern equine and lacrosse encephalitis and some other ones. And there are other mosquito species out there in our area that are associated with those, but the main one that comes to mind for spreading disease would be that Culex pipiens species in particular.
PJ Leash is a UW Extension entomologist. He's joined by La Crosse County Health Department Director Jen Rombalski and Gunderson Health System Infectious Disease Doctor David McNamara. They've been talking about the health complications caused by mosquitoes and ticks. Coming up, we'll continue our conversations on ticks and mosquitoes and the health problems they can cause. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. We continue with the topic of health problems associated with ticks and mosquitoes. Our guests are La Crosse County Health Department Director Jen Rombalski and Gunnarsson Health System Infectious Disease Doctor David McNamara. WPR's John Davis asked University of Wisconsin Extension entomologist P.J. Leash if populations of disease-causing ticks and mosquitoes are growing.
That's a really interesting question, and it's an interesting topic to look at over time. If you go back far enough, in the days of early statehood and even before that, I mean, we're talking early 1800s, mid-1800s, Wisconsin at that time used to have fairly significant issues with malaria. And we do have mosquitoes around today that in theory could carry it, but due to some of the human activities in the state, things like draining wetlands, but also having better construction with our homes, with window screens and things like that, so those mosquitoes aren't getting in, malaria has really become a non-issue for us in Wisconsin, whereas, as I said, historically, that was a bigger problem for us. So things change over time. We saw just in the last, 20, 30 years, things like West Nile virus popping up, so that's a concern. For some of the other diseases we hear about in the news, and I'm referring to things like Zika virus and dengue fever and chikungunya and things like that, we see almost no cases here other than situations where folks had maybe traveled down to Central or South America or the far southern U.S., acquired those diseases there, and then came back to Wisconsin. And a reason for that is there are two mosquito species in particular that are particularly bad apples, so to speak, when it comes to those diseases, and that would be Aedes aegypti, the yellow fever mosquito, and Aedes albopictus, the Asian tiger mosquito. And for the most part, we don't have those mosquitoes here. Our winters are likely too cold for them, so that may change over time. There have been some recent papers looking at, with climate change and models, perhaps some of those mosquito species will increase their range and kind of push their way northward. So the disease situation may change over time, but for the moment, Zika and dengue and chikungunya aren't an issue here. You have to go to much more southern latitudes before you bump into mosquito transmission of those particular diseases.
BJ, compared to other parts of the world, Wisconsin probably does not have the greatest prevalence of insect-related illness, does it?
No, I mean, if you look at it globally, think of places like sub-Saharan Africa and South America and Southeast Asia and worldwide. I mean, malaria is still a very, very significant disease. Parts of Africa, there's many other arthropod-borne diseases as well. So, I mean, relatively speaking, we don't have the big malaria problem other parts of the globe have, but still, I mean, we do have diseases of concern when we hear about the Lyme disease and West Nile virus and things like that. I do want to emphasize that we do need to be aware of these and make sure we are taking precautions for them because they are out there.
That's P.J. Leash, a UW Extension entomologist. We're also joined by Dr. David McNamara from Gunnarsson Lutheran Infectious Disease Department and Jen Rombalski, La Crosse County's Health Department Director. Our show today is about the health problems caused by insects. Jen, I know you had mentioned you were going to a recent conference on this topic.
Mm-hmm. It was actually at UW-Madison.
What
mm-hmm.
did you learn?
I learned a lot. I learned, I learned a lot of what we talked about today, or reinforced what I knew already. But I learned how to do some of the testing in the field. So, like tick dragging. Last year, we had a Rocky Mountain spotted fever death, and we felt like we knew about the area where that person may have contracted that tick. It was possible it was also in the very eastern part of Minnesota, but we did ask UW-Madison staff to come up and do a tick dragging. Easter egg, and now we would be able to do that ourselves at the health department. So, you know, that's really a method in the field for determining or seeing if you can collect some of the ticks that are in that area and then identifying them and utilizing sometimes, you know, if you have enough resources, which we may not here, but there are also ways that you can, once you've identified and sorted different types of even ticks or mosquitoes, then you can test them for certain disease. So UW-Madison's lab has the capacity to do that, or I should say the Midwest Center for Excellence for Vector-Borne Disease has the capacity to test mosquitoes for the prevalence of virus in those mosquitoes. But it is somewhat resource-intensive when you include all of the pieces of collecting the mosquitoes, identifying them, and such. But
I want to talk a little bit more about that Rocky Mountain spotted fever case that we had. For the two of you in the studio, what do we learn from a case like that that we can go forward with?
Well, from my perspective, it really comes back again to being aware that it was tick season and that you know, if you're in an area where it's surrounded by trees, and we're seeing even in urban areas that have tree lines in a, you know, or a suburban area that has a tree line, we're finding ticks not here locally, but in the state where they're doing surveillance. There's ticks being found further out from the tree line than you might expect. And so, you know, if you're at a campground or if you're, you know, doing some other activity where ticks might be present, you know, again, we have to just constantly be vigilant of these little creatures that can transmit disease. And Rocky Mountain spotted fever is transmitted by the wood tick, not the deer tick. So the deer tick is by far the more concerning tick for us. But it just so happens that that wood tick does transmit that disease as well. So you just need to be doing tick checks, getting those things off as soon as possible. It typically takes about 24 hours for the tick to transmit disease. It has to be attached for about 24 hours. So that's why we can still, even if we have one attached, we can pull it off. And if we know that it's only been recent that we've been in the woods, you know, we still have to be monitoring ourselves for symptoms, but that's, you know, at least you caught it and we're doing tick checks and could pull it off.
Dr. McNamara, do you take anything from that case of Rocky Mountain spotted fever last year?
A couple things. So the first is that Rocky Mountain spotted fever has been recognized previously to occur in the upper Midwest, but it's extremely rare. So there have been a handful of cases in the last 10 or 20 years that were recognized in Minnesota and Wisconsin. So it's a very rare disease. One of my partners, an extremely astute infectious disease physician, made that diagnosis and worked with Wisconsin State Lab in Madison, as well as their partners at the CDC, to do the confirmatory testing. We've had at Gunderson Health System, in response to that case, we pushed out some education about that. But it really is a challenge in that it's a very rare diagnosis. And we want to have healthcare providers be aware of uncommon things that are rare and potentially deadly. Although I would certainly agree with Jen that the common everyday things that is as a state and a population we need to concern ourselves with are things that relate to, like the deer tick or a vaccine preventable illness like measles, that kind of thing. But Rocky Mountain spotted fever, it was reported here as, you know, there was a fatality a few years ago in Minnesota. That Minnesota Department of Health pushed out a lot of awareness and education to clinicians in Minnesota about that. And it was a case in western Minnesota, out near South Dakota, that led to a fatality in a young girl. But there are some rare, uncommon things that we do see.
PJ, did you take anything from that case of Rocky Mountain spotted fever last year?
Well, I would simply second what's already been said, especially the note about Rocky Mountain spotted fever overall being really pretty rare in our area. We don't see that many cases of it in comparison to the Lyme disease and then things like anaplasmosis. But as Jen had said, you know, folks do need to take precautions. And one thing I would like to mention is that sometimes folks can get a false sense of security. You know, they may simply not be tick aware and be thinking about ticks. Every year, as soon as the snow melts out, I start getting tick reports here at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And so if it's a really early thaw and we have a warm spell in February, I mean, you could potentially be bumping into ticks in January or February. And folks may not be thinking about it at the time. So we do need to have everyone being aware of ticks and making sure that they're taking precautions so that even though the things like Rocky Mountain spotted fever are out there and they're rare, but we need to be thinking about it.
La Crosse encephalitis is an illness that was diagnosed here. And Jen, could you talk a little bit about the history of that and are we still seeing it at rates that we used to see it in La Crosse?
So those are great questions. So this is an interesting disease because it was diagnosed here. And so La Crosse encephalitis was first found in a four-year-old in La Crosse. And so that's a very young child. That was in 1963. And since then, the virus has really been found in a number of Midwestern and Mid-Atlantic states. During the average year, about 75 cases of La Crosse encephalitis that are reported to the Centers for Disease Control, or the CDC. According to our records in La Crosse County, we haven't seen a case in quite some time, of a resident in our county. So that's good news. We've also been doing lots of surveillance activities for decades because of that initial case, I think, as well. So there have been some tough situations with that disease. It can be very, you know, it affects the brain and it causes inflammation. And I'm sure Dr. McNamara will talk about that and how severe that particular disease can be.
Is it just vigilance that we get down to having no cases of it for a long time?
And some luck, I think. So we are specifically looking for and treating the types of environments where this type of mosquito likes to breed. But from my understanding, the types of traps that you can set to catch adult mosquitoes and identify them will often not catch this particular mosquito. So our knowledge of how prevalent this particular mosquito really is in our county, we don't have any disease. We are treating any environment that may be a breeding ground for this mosquito, but we can't be in every environment. There are tree holes out there that we don't know about, I'm sure. So yes, it's a mixture of both. It's actually three things. It's the surveillance activities that we're doing. It's the vigilance that people have where they're protecting themselves from mosquito bites, and it's just some luck.
Dr. McNamara, do you have any thoughts on La Crosse encephalitis and the fact we don't see a lot of it anymore?
So we see viral encephalitis cases probably at least several per year at the Gunderson Lutheran Medical Center. In a lot of those cases, maybe 40 to 50% of the time, despite very careful testing of the spinal fluid as well as blood antibodies, we're unable to make a specific identification of what the causative virus or germ may be. But I would say, you know, we've certainly seen cases of viral encephalitis where the testing for the California serogroup virus was positive. We've seen couple of those cases in the last 10 years or so at Gunderson, and they certainly may not have been of a La Crosse County resident. But we see a wide variety of other things that can cause that, too. We've had, in the last few years, two cases of Powassan virus that we diagnosed at Gunderson, and those persons had, you know, very severe brain inflammation. And we certainly see some ongoing West Nile virus cases.
Is there anything else anybody wants to add that we maybe didn't cover?
I just want to add that, you know, there are so many wonderful benefits to nature. So I just want to sort of balance out the conversation with, yes, there are these ticks and mosquitoes out there that can transmit disease, but we do have ways that we can protect ourselves. And if we're taking those precautions, there's no reason that we shouldn't be enjoying the outdoors. We have some beautiful spots around our area. And so I don't want people to be so fearful that they aren't getting out there and enjoying the nature. It's so good for us from a health perspective. But we just can't say it enough how important it is to take those precautions. They are very important.
When it comes to insects and other arthropods out there, I mean, the focus of the show today has been on a lot of the negative aspects, you know, the diseases they can transmit. I like to remind folks, though, you know, if we had a magic scale that could kind of balance all the good things insects and other arthropods do with all the bad things that they do, insects and other arthropods do a lot more good for us than bad. You know, pollination services, out there breaking down and recycling dead plant materials and roadkill and things like that. And all of those ecosystem services that they provide are crucially important for mankind, for us to be able to eat and enjoy the outdoors and things like that. So I think we need to be aware of some of these bad apples in the bunch, so to speak, but the vast majority of our insects and other arthropods are really doing beneficial things for us out in the ecosystem.
P.J. Leash is an entomologist for the University of Wisconsin Extension. He's been joined by Gunderson Health System infectious disease doctor David McNamara and La Crosse County Health Department Director Jen Rombalski. They've been talking about the health complications caused by mosquitoes and ticks. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers. Our site has archives of other past editions of Newsmakers, and if you'd like to share comments or make suggestions for future shows, you'll find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/newsmakers.